The Bernard Brogan Podcast and OTB Sports with Super Value. The stands may be silent, but supporting where you're from has never been so important. Super Value supporting the GAA All-Ireland Football Championship for over 11 years. Bringing you the best of GAA conversations.
Hello and welcome to the Bernard Brogan Podcast here on OTB Sports. Brought to you by Super Value, proud sponsors of the 2020 Championship. This is episode 2. Tommy Bow, how are you?
Bernard, how are you? Good to chat. Nice to be on the podcast. Number 2. Who was number 1?
You're on the podium. We had Ty Kennelly on, who was a great pal of mine. So I really appreciate your time. I know you have an early start with Ireland AM. You're just off the air. So appreciate you staying awake for me for a few minutes.
Well, I'll do my best. Yeah, no, it is early starts at the minute. We're literally just off air talking all sorts of crazy stuff. But looking forward to the chat. Looking forward to the chat.
Yeah, no, it's like I'm seeing you everywhere. I just enjoyed Monday night sitting down, watching sport. Sport has been a massive kind of distraction for me over COVID to see GA back and rugby and even to soccer as well. But yeah, and you're doing a great job there, and a busy Monday night for you, and then you're up early on the for Ireland AM. How are you coping? How are you managing?
Yeah, well, that's it. Sunday and Monday this week, obviously with Air Sport doing the Pro 14, and then Ireland AM Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So listen, it is busy, but in terms of the sport, I really think the Monday night rugby with the Pro 14 has been brilliant. I think the teams have really bought into it. The standard of rugby has been great. And given the internationals, the Autumn Nations Cup is on at the weekends, having something to watch on a Monday night has been great. And, I definitely think Carragher and Neville could definitely learn something from me and Darcy at Stringer.
That is a fact, but, yeah. Well, the standard of sport is a lot more entertaining in the rugby than some of the Monday night football, even though Carragher and Neville are good entertainment. But the standard of rugby has been phenomenal. And even with the length at the internationals, lads away, the Irish provinces have really kind of been phenomenal. They're just standing head and shoulders above, but it looks at things.
I think that the Irish provinces really have. I think that it just highlights exactly what an impressive job the IRFU do. I mean, it is phenomenal. There's so much talk about the IRFU and about their development and pathways and the schools, but actually how they have kept the show on the road and kept the provinces just progressing, and the amount of players coming through underage, because if you look at Ireland under 20s compared to Scotland under 20s and Wales under 20s, they're all fairly competitive. But these under 20s are coming through an incredible pathway into the senior teams compared that the Welsh and the Scottish, they just can't compete.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting for Irish rugby going forward. It's a little bit worrying from an international and from the other regions, because the Welsh regions, you know, they are really not competitive at the minute. Yeah. And that needs to be worked on there, because I know the WRU over in Wales are struggling financially, the SRU Scotland as well. So it's difficult times for everybody. And from myself and Peter and Gordon's point of view, we are just so, so fortunate and lucky that we get to be pitch side for these games, because, you know, standing in an empty RDS on Monday, it was class to be up so close to the players, but you really, really miss the supporters. Yeah. Like, we're trying to drum up atmosphere, but you feed off the, it's like when you play, Bernard, you feed off the energy, you feed off the crowd behind you, and shouting, the Leinster supporters shouting a bit of abuse or cheering and jeering, and
Does it affect the players, do you think? Obviously, watching the Dubs there the last day, they put in a good performance in the end, and Leinster look like they're flying as well. Do you think that the players are, like, you as a player, would it have made much of a difference not to have the stands there? As a spectacle for us as supporters and watching, the atmosphere is massive, but for the players, do you think it's affecting them?
I think definitely rugby has been really affected. I think the standard of rugby has been pretty good, but there's a real emotional attachment when you're playing rugby, because you're putting your body on your line, on the line. Whenever you are making some of the hits and the tackles, you feed off the adrenaline that a crowd bring. And maybe not at the Pro 14 level, but I certainly think at the Six Nations matches that just went in the Autumn Nations Cup, there's not the build-up, the hype. I mean, it's Ireland-England this weekend, and if this was a Six Nations match with the crowd there, everywhere you go, you couldn't go down the street without people wishing you well. Everybody gets so up for it. But because there's no crowd there, it's a new competition, it just doesn't feel quite the same energy about it.
And yeah, it has been like, a subdued kind of build-up to it, which is always a big game. We'll talk a little bit more rugby and other bits, but first I wanted to just jump back all the way back to a great GA county and town of Emmyvale and telling me a little bit about your background. And obviously any GA people listening would be very interested to hear your exploits in GAA as a kid, and I know you're a very sporting family, but tell me a little bit about where you're from and what your upbringing was like.
Well, listen, GAA was everything to me growing up. I'm from a little village called Emmyvale, which is in North Monaghan. And listen, Monaghan wouldn't be renowned for their rugby, that's for sure. There's only one rugby club in the whole county. But my dad is actually from Waterford and my mum was from Kildare. They both came to live in Emmyvale through work. But really, growing up, Gaelic football was everything to me. I played for the local parish, Emmyvale. You know, we played some of the rivalries between Scotstown and Ballybay and Monaghan Harps. These rivalries, I still remember the emotional attachment to it. And I loved my days playing Gaelic football, you know, and I actually attribute a huge amount of my, you know, the skills that I got from playing Gaelic football transformed into the rugby side of things. So I think actually playing a couple of sports like that is really, really beneficial.
I'd strongly believe in that as well. And I know that you're a fan, you would have been involved in a lot of sports as a kid. I myself included the same, and would have felt that other sports and that kind of trying other things, different skill sets, different movements, plays a big part into whatever sport you pick. Obviously, I play GAA, but you would attribute some of those skills that you got from the different sports you played as a kid. I know your sister was an amazing hockey player. I know your brother plays rugby, but you would have played all sorts of sports as kids. And would you attribute a lot of your skills to catching, this movement, the ball, the footwork? Would you attribute that to the different sports you played?
Do you know, it was funny, Bernard, whenever I was growing up, because Gaelic football was so big in Monaghan, it used to be the Gaelic season started on St. Patrick's Day and it went right through to, I think, September. And then from September on through to St. Patrick's Day was kind of the rugby season. And that's the way we broke it up. And every year when I came back from Gaelic football to start the rugby season, I was playing the best rugby I'd ever played. Because certain things like attacking the ball, you know yourself, when there's a kick out, in Gaelic football, it's always all about attacking the ball, trying to catch it at the highest point in the air. Where if you watch in rugby, they very much cradle the ball, they catch it into their chest. So things like that, you know, have definitely, you know, it's something that you saw Andrew Conway at the weekend catching high balls above his head, and it's definitely a skill set within Irish rugby that we need to really excel and try to use, because so many of the Irish rugby team have come through Gaelic backgrounds. And I think that's something that Joe Schmidt tried to bring into. Now, I don't want to be bringing us back to our box kicks again, but it is something that we definitely need to try, because we are, we do have that strength above a lot of other nations. But definitely from in taking different skill sets, I grew up doing a lot of sprinting, a lot of athletics. I did horse riding, the tennis, golf, soccer, Gaelic football. I was very much a firm believer. We came from a family where we were a jack of all trades and a master's at none. And my dad was very, very keen, and my mum was very keen to push us to try everything. And eventually you'll find your way. And none of us expected me to go on to play for Ireland, or Hannah, my sister, to go on and play for Ireland for hockey. You know, that wasn't what it was about. Of course, that was the dream, but it was about enjoying sport. And I really think that in these crazy times that we're in at the minute, underage sport is so important. And I think we need to put more emphasis into it, because kids and teenagers are going through really difficult times at the minute. And sport is one area that I think that just gets a weight off people's minds. It's good socially, it's good for values, and it's good for so many other ways for life beyond sport.
Yeah, 100%. And you say you're a jack of all trades, master of none. I doubt that. I'd say anything you turned your hand to, you were successful at. The draw to rugby, obviously living in Monaghan, a GA stronghold. I know your dad won a senior cup medal back when Newbridge, back in the 70s. Yeah. Was that, like myself, I played everything, love soccer, never got a chance to play rugby, unfortunately, but GA was always where I was drawn to. Maybe it was the legacy of my dad and that. Was it something similar for you?
Do you know what happened was, from a young age, Gaelic football would have been my favourite, but I ended up going to school in Armagh, which is just over the other side of the border. And rugby was very much the main sport there. So right through until I was about 16 or 17, I played rugby in the wintertime, Gaelic football in the summer. And they were really the two main sports I was playing. And it came to under 17s, and I'd represented our Monaghan at under 16s, at under 17s. And I think I played just a kind of a friendly match for Monaghan Miners, but they wanted me to train during the winter season. And that was obviously when I was playing rugby. And that's when, so I was kind of 17, 18, and I had to make the decision then whether I was going to go with Gaelic football or rugby. And I stuck with rugby in school. It was all we lived, breathed, ate rugby at that stage. And listen, again, Bernard, at that age, I didn't play for Ulster schools. I didn't play for Ireland schools. I didn't get accepted into the Ireland Academy. Even I was a wild card getting into the Ulster Academy. I actually did my A-levels in the north. And if everything went to plan, I was going to go to Scotland to university and do a property course over there and just play rugby socially. And the way it happened, my A-levels didn't go to plan and I didn't get into the course that I wanted to. And my rugby coach from the school got in touch with Alan Clark, who was head of the Ulster Academy at the time, and asked him to give me a trial. And I turned up at the trial. I had bleach blonde hair. I'd just come back from a lad's holiday with a blue stripe down the middle of it. And it had all faded and gone green. It was horrific looking. But whatever happened in that trial, I played out of my skin. And I got called into the Ulster Academy as a complete wild card. Studied a construction engineering course up in University of Ulster. And from there, within 2 years, I pretty much 18, 19 and 20 had my first cap for Ireland. So wow. Things really progressed very, very fast. But, yeah. You know, it's a sliding doors moment. It could have been so, so different.
And what was it like just that from going from Monaghan, that going across the border to school? Were you conscious of that or playing rugby and been from a GA place? Was that in the back of your mind or were you just a young guy getting after it?
Yeah, do you know what? Like it was, the school is called Royal School Armagh. I'm a Catholic from Monaghan. There was another guy who went to school with me as well from Monaghan. We were in the same class and it was a predominantly Protestant school, Protestant class that we were in. And yeah, there was always a bit of slagging and listen, I think it's schoolboys and I think that's just what you got to expect. But we grew a thick skin pretty quickly and we were well able to stand up for ourselves. But yeah. It's never really something that affected me too much. I enjoyed the banter of it all. I enjoyed the slagging, you know, around the whole 12th of July, myself and Connor, my friend from Monaghan, we used to like pretend to be disrupting the protests. And they, like, it was a lot of messing back in those days at school, like every boy knows. And yeah, you grew a thick skin, but at the same time, it was just about learning with, you know, you're meeting people from other side of the border. I mean, that's something that we had really dealt with before, even though I was so close to the border. So I think it was a good way to see that the way the world is going now, because I started in secondary school in 1995. Now, the Troubles were well past at that stage, but things were just starting to get better. And you know, I've spent a long, long time in Northern Ireland now, and I never come across any trouble, which is brilliant.
Great. Fair play, yeah. Amazing, yeah. So going from there, similar to yourself, I went through that underroot wildcard type scenario. Maybe having my brother ahead of me got me there. As you progressed, I think 2003, you come into Ulster, you score a try in your debut. You obviously household name, and you had some great days, you had some injuries, you had all these different things. When would you say was your peak? At what stage of your career did you feel, this is me where I need to be? I know in 2009, you had a good year, you had the Lions Tour. 2010, you won some awards. What would you say in your own self when you look back at it? That was when I was at my pump.
Yeah, listen, I'll probably more remember the times that I wasn't at my peak, which is crazy. And that's just a sports person, as I know you're probably the same, that you remember the bad days more than you remember the good days. But you mentioned 2009 there. I had just left Ulster and gone to the Ospreys, which at the time was something that people didn't do, that Irish players, if they were playing for their province week in, week out, they just didn't leave. And I remember my contract was up with Ulster. And I think Ulster and the IRFU just felt I was trying to push up my price of my contract when I said that I was going to leave. And they didn't quite believe me. And then all of a sudden, I told them that I'd signed for the Ospreys. And it was a real shock at the time. But the Ospreys were an unbelievable team at that stage. They had 13 players in the Welsh team that had just won the Grand Slam. They were, you know, one of the really high-flying teams. And unlike, you see, Simon Zeebo and Johnny Sexton going to France, I knew that if I went to a club still in the same league, that I would be playing against an Irish province once in every 3 or 4 weeks. Mm. So it meant that for Declan Kidney, who was the coach at the time, he didn't have to take a flight over to Paris just to watch me play one game. He could watch the Ospreys playing against Leinster 1 week and see all the Leinster players plus me, or me against Ulster. So that kept me very much in the eyesight of the coaches, even though I was out of the country. But moving to a new club was the best thing that I ever did, because it pushed me out of my comfort zone. At the time, I couldn't get into the Irish team. Eddie O'Sullivan was coached, it was his last season. And just no matter how well I was playing for Ulster, I just couldn't get myself back into the team. And that's why I thought it needed to make a change and try something new. And it just pushed me to a new level. I trained harder than I'd ever trained before to try and get the respect of my teammates, my new teammates. And moving over there, just a change of scenery. The Ospreys played a different style of rugby, very much open, free-flowing style of rugby. And it just suited me down to the ground. And that year, I had a brilliant year for the Ospreys. I got myself back into the Irish team. We won the Grand Slam and got to go and play for the Lions over in South Africa, which, you know, playing for the Lions, playing for Ireland was always my dream. Playing for the Lions was beyond a dream. You know, I watched the 97 Lions video when they won over in South Africa. Must have watched that tape till it's broken, and never, ever dreamt of going on a Lions tour. Unfortunately, I've been on two, but they're the best memories I'll ever have.
Did you ever wonder why you weren't picked for Ireland? Was it that that Eddie didn't think you were good enough, or Declan didn't think you were good enough, or what do you think?
Do you know, listen, Bernard, I think it's a little bit like you. You know, I came through the system very, I didn't come through fast, and I came through very fast, and I got my first cap when I was 20. I kind of had maybe 5, 6, 7 caps by the time I was about 21, 22. But it all came quite fast to me. And I didn't take it very well. I probably wasn't good enough to be picked at the time. Dennis Hickey, Shane Horgan were both on the wings at that stage. And I wasn't at the standard that I needed to be pushing them. And I remember I played against France in the Stade de France over in Paris. Mm. And I tell this story all the time that it wasn't my best game, but I got taken off after 50 minutes. And the following day after the match, I just tried to keep my head down. I didn't want to read any papers. I didn't want to look at any of the coaches in the eye. I just knew I needed to get to Monday morning for training to start again. And I got a text message from one of my good mates from Monaghan. And he said, the text message said, "Listen, mate, don't listen to that bollocks Neil Francis." So, of course, I had to ask him, what did he do? What's he said? And he goes, "Oh, he's giving you a 0 out of 10 on the paper." So you'd think you'd get a 1 for just running out onto the par. But so, listen, you know, at that sort of stage, I wasn't probably playing that well. And that hit me quite hard as well. And it took me to go back to Ulster, to Mark McCall, who was the head coach at the time, who's now the head coach at Saracens, brilliant head coach. Mm. And he kind of put his arm around me and, you know, told me to focus on what I was doing with Ulster. And after a season or two, I really found my confidence again, got back playing some good rugby and eventually pushed my way back into the Irish team.
What did you do to get that confidence back? Was it just hard work, or was there certain skills you went after? Just... what was the key things that changed that dynamic for you?
A lot of hard work, a lot of soul searching. I actually went to see 3 sports psychologists. which was something that my mum kind of pushed me into doing, because back in these days, it wasn't something people did.
Yeah.
And there was no one thing from any psychologist that really stuck. I took different things from all three, and right through to the end of my career. And even now, I use some of the things like visualization and little words, trigger words that just kind of like, I suppose, get you out of that red zone where your head is going a million miles an hour. So things like that helped. But one huge thing that Mark McCall got me to focus on was, when you're a young player coming through, everybody tells you to work on your weaknesses and keep, you know, you're not very good at that, keep working on it. But you almost lose sight in your strengths, and you push your strengths to a side. And what he wanted me to do, I was standing on the wing playing for Ulster in the freezing cold weather, but I was standing out wide, never touching the ball because no one passed it to me. So he said, you know, if you want to work on your strengths, you have to get the ball in hand, go searching for the ball, be hungry all the time. So that's something that I really tried to work on, that, you know, I need, of course, to practice my kicking with my left foot and my right foot. I need to practice my handoffs or my tackling, but your strength is taking people on. And if you can go and score 3-4 tries in a game, you know, those things eventually will catch up, and that's something that I definitely focused on.
I love that, yeah. That strength in your strengths mentality is something that I buy into. As you said, you can spend a lot of time making small benefits in the things you're weak at, but if you go after things you're really strong at, you can make big marginal differences, and as you say,
absolutely,
the rest will catch up. So, no, I'm
firm. And listen, it is important to work on those strengths, but there's no point in getting fixated on it, because, you know, if it's something that it doesn't come naturally to you and you get fixated on, it'll dent your confidence because you're not able to do it, where something that comes naturally and you're very good at, and you're the these strengths are the reason you get to that position in the first place. So you can't forget of those. You have to try and kick them onto a new level.
I talk a lot about flow state, and I know I'm sure it's the same in rugby. And for me, it was about when I got the ball and I was taking on a man, and I felt as if I couldn't miss. And I just felt that every time I got the ball, I had that confidence to do something special. In rugby, what does flow state mean? Or when you, like, I know you scored a try in Ireland's game against Wales to get the first Grand Slam in 61 years. You've had some amazing big moments. And you talk about there about being stuck on the line as a winger or a full back, and the game can pass you by depending on the style of play. Is flow state a thing in rugby that you feel confident? And what does it mean for you as a player on the wing or in fullback?
Well, this is the thing about rugby that's so different, because you have the forwards and the scrum half and the out half, like Johnny Sexton, who's involved in everything. Where it was actually Jacob Stockdale spoke about it a week or two ago, about how at fullback and the wing, there are maybe 5-10 minutes in a game where you actually don't have much to do. You're constantly covering just in case somebody does kick at your area. But it's keeping your focus on. And that's something that the sports psychologist worked an awful lot on me, is staying in the moment all the time. Because, you know, when you're in Croke Park or the Aviva Stadium, you look up and you can get overawed by the crowd. And, you know, when you're so close to the touchline, you can actually hear people shouting at you. So when you're in your flow state, you're very much just focused in, zoned in on the game and zoned in on how you can impact it. So yeah, there's absolutely, it's different for different positions. But from my point of view on the wing, very early on in my career, I was a disaster for zoning out. I go do something great and then all of a sudden I drop a really simple ball because I just lose my concentration. And it's something for a back three player, you know, in rugby in particular, that's something, if you want to get to the top level, you have to be able to focus on your job and stay focused on the game all the time.
Yeah. As you got a bit older, unfortunately we both got old, and obviously you might slow down a bit, or you're looking at these young guys coming in that have went through the strength and conditioning programs that we didn't have the luxury of having maybe when we were younger.
No.
When you were looking over your shoulder and seeing these guys coming at you and looking and some injuries, how did your mindset shift into that kind of maybe a new role or as things were kind of as you're getting a bit older in life, did your mindset have to have a shift? Mine did. I'm just wondering how you actually, what changed for you?
100%. You know, whenever I came out of school, I was a beanpole. I was so skinny, didn't do any weights. We didn't have, I remember the only weights that we did, we had a broom handle and we used to have to practice doing cleans. And then all of a sudden, now when I was coming towards the end of my career, you're having these kids coming out of school and they were bench pressing more than me and they were squatting more than me and they were just these units. And unfortunately, injuries were starting to catch up with me at that stage. You know, and I finished up with the Ospreys. I moved back to Ulster. And really, that was when injuries really started to come thick and heavy. I think I probably had to have one or two operations a year. And when you're seeing the likes of the Stockdales and these young players just constantly coming through and they're biting at your heels. But I loved it. That's when I got to the stage where I loved being, you know, I saw myself as the number one winger and I wanted to keep that position. And no matter who was coming through, that was my mission, to do whatever I needed to do. And I think that, yes, I might have lost a yard of pace, but I think my game management and my brain, I knew. The thing is about being a poacher, and you know all about this, is that you have to take the gamble. So you have to be there that split second before the defender or before the other player on your team. And those strikers, say, in soccer, like it's an inch or two, and that's the difference between catching a ball or heading a ball and being able to get through. So, you know, my thing was about using my head to try and see where the ball was going to be and be there before anybody else. And that just comes with the experience. So yeah. I loved the challenge of it, because you're always, whenever you're playing professional sport or any level of sport, it's the challenge. Where's the next challenge? Who am I going to beat next? Who am I up against? You know, I want to beat that. I want to score a try. Or I want to come back from injury. And that became my biggest challenge. Was I'd get injured, I'd train so hard to get myself back fit again, and you get back up to this level where you're playing in a World Cup or a Six Nations, you couldn't be fitter, you couldn't be faster, and all of a sudden you break your leg and you're right back down to square one again, and mentally that's the toughest out of everything.
And you're talking about the physical nature of the game now. Like, I'm looking at some of the hits. Obviously, played a sport where it's physical enough, but some of the hits are just phenomenal now. And the concussions, like, there's probably one or two people a game going off for HIA checks and stuff like that. Where do you see it going in the sport? And here, they're not going to stop doing weights. They're not going to stop getting bigger. That's what makes the game, I suppose, so interesting to watch. Do you see it being an issue, something that needs to be looked at, or...?
I think World Rugby are definitely trying to find ways to mix it up a bit, so it's not just at the moment. Defence has become so big in every team that really, when you're carrying a ball, you're running into a flat wall and they only have one player in the backfield. So World Rugby are trying to find ways of creating more space on the park. So they're trying to create ways to reward teams by being able to kick the ball into the corner, very like what Ronan O'Gara was such a genius at, that if you can kick the ball and bounce it into the 22, you will get a line out in there. So that would force the opposition backfield to defend all that space at the back more, rather than just being in the front line, a big blanket defense. So it's something that the IRFU are looking at, and I think it needs to happen, because the game is becoming so, so attritional. But listen, I kind of feel sometimes watching Gaelic football as well, you know, and even I spoke to Sean Kavanagh there a little while ago, and he was telling me about the hits, you know, the shoulders that he gets. And I just think that, and the strength and conditioning that's coming into all sports now, they are just getting so physically demanding. And I think that that's just the way it's going to go. But if you think back to the last World Cup in Japan, the biggest success story of that whole tournament was not that South Africa won it, which was incredible given the story of Siya Kolisi, their captain, but South Africa are a team about strength and power, but Japan got to the semi-finals playing with speed and skill, and they showed other teams around the world that you can compete with the best by playing with skill and with speed. And I think that's the way the game's going to have to go. I think we have to find a way that our skill level is improved. And I know they're talking about changing the global season, that we'll play a little bit more rugby in the summertime. And that would be great, because, you know, when you're going into I know the Gaelic football lads are worried about playing, you know, championship matches in December when the rain's pouring down.
You're well used to it, aren't you? Around Christmas time.
It's not pretty, and certainly a winger standing on the touchline, it's not something I enjoyed either. So I would love to play more rugby in the summertime. I think that the skill level would be so much better. It would be much better spectacle. But these are decisions that World Rugby are looking at the minute, and personally, I think it would only be a good thing.
Yeah, and there is some great kind of rules brought in around high tackles, stuff like that. There is, the referees are, but a lot more strict on the dangerous side of the game. So, in fairness,
they're having to clamp down on it, because nowadays, like, all the old players all go on about all the stuff that went on off the ball now, but there are cameras all over these pitches nowadays. Players can't get away with anything, and if there is a nasty tackle or somebody lands awkwardly, you know, the TV cameras, I know it with Air Sport, we zoom in on it and we show slow-mo replays, which almost, you know, make it look worse. So they have to do their bit to try and make the game safer, and also for parents who are watching at home to feel that it's safe to send their kids out to play.
100%, yeah, because you want the next generation of kids, and I've heard about parents saying that they're a bit worried about it, you know what I mean? So that these measures are for the future of the game and the grassroots is 100%.
You can't deny that. And the more you see these slow-mo shots of these nasty challenges, my wife wouldn't be best pleased probably watching it either. But you have to believe that, I think rugby as a game, yes, it is physical and it is demanding on the body, and certainly the operations and the knocks I've had to show that shows for it. But I think, like any sport, the values that you get from playing sport far outweigh the physical 100%. Physical side of it.
100%. Okay, and so when you were coming towards the end, what kind of triggered in your mind? Obviously, you played, I think until you were 34, you got a great career and great longevity. I know you had injuries, but you were lucky to have a very long career. What was the spark or the switch that kind of said, right, that's enough for me? Or was it that you couldn't keep up with the young lads, or was it the body was saying that's enough? Or
a bit of both, to be honest with you. It hit me really when I was about 30. I remember Stephen Ferris would have been a good friend of mine up in Ulster in Ireland. He had to retire when he was 26. I think he just landed awkwardly in a line out, busted his ankle. And at that stage, Stephen Ferris was playing out of his skin. I mean, he was up there with one of the best players in the world. And all of a sudden, just like that, you know, his career was over. Felix Jones was another one who, me and him were, myself, him and Andrew Trimble were neck and neck who was going to get picked to go to the World Cup. And I got the nod and Felix Jones didn't get picked. And by the time I came home from the World Cup, he had retired from rugby because he'd had a nasty knock. So, you know, that's when it hit home to me that this sport is so fickle. And I'd always studied, I'd done that engineering course while playing. I'd done a postgrad in business. But I'd been involved in my shoe and clothing brands as well, which I always thought was something very important for me. It doesn't suit maybe the likes of like Paul O'Connell or Johnny Sexton, who are so zoned in on the game. For me, though, I always needed something that if I had a bad game or a bad training session, I could hop in the car and make a few phone calls and just completely talk about something different. And that's why I was just different, maybe to different players.
Yeah.
Some players like to just have 100% focus, some don't. But it was around, I was 33. And well, what happened was, so I tried everything. I was coming back from a nasty knee injury at the World Cup. And it took me 11 months to get myself back fit and playing again. But I know you had towards the end of your career, Bernard, you put everything into it to try and get yourself back fit. You made it back in record time with that knee injury. And I got myself back into the Ireland team just about by the skin of my teeth. And I remember a lot of the pundits were asking what the hell I was doing getting picked for, but they didn't see behind the scenes how I was ticking every box and doing everything I could for Joe Schmidt. But in the Welsh game against Wales over in the Millennium Stadium, it was the same stadium that 16 months before I had wrecked my knee in the World Cup. And I came on in the 79th minute and 14 seconds. And I got the ball and got tackled by Jamie Roberts, and he landed on my leg and I felt a crack. And I remember saying to the referee blew the whistle, Wayne Barnes, said, "Scrum down, Wales ball." I said, "Wayne, sorry, I think I've broken my leg." And he said, "What? You're just on the pitch." I said, "Yeah, I heard a crack." And the same buggy, the same medics took me off the pitch into the same medical room at 79 minutes and 54 seconds. So my final time ever playing for Ireland, I was on the pitch for 40 seconds. Wow. But I remember being taken off the park, and I knew that I had put everything in to get myself back onto that international stage again. And people said, you know, you were smiling coming off. And I was only smiling because you either laugh or you cry. You know, it would be the last time you'll ever play for Ireland, but also the fact that I'd left everything out there. So
yeah, fair play.
I had one more year left in my contract. And I told Bryn Cunningham from Ulster Rugby that, listen, don't worry about me for another contract. This is me done. And I got to really enjoy the last year. I got to take all the pressure off. I didn't care whether Joe Schmidt was watching me, whether I needed to. I didn't, you know, it took all the pressure off. And I actually got to really enjoy rugby again for the last year without the pressures that you put yourself under.
Nice.
And it was able to be nice to look back at my last training session, my last home game for Ulster, and, you know, my family, a lot of friends there too. So great memories.
Fair play. Yeah, I actually didn't know. I'd forgotten that story about the Ireland thing. That's an interesting story. I had something similar myself on my way out. I didn't get onto the pitch. I was hoping for the last 40 seconds. It's nice to get them, and it just shows. I was the same. I fought tooth and nail just to put that jersey back on. I know you were the same, and that's why I walked off with a smile. So how
that's it, because you got back for the replay. Yeah. And listen, it's the same, I know. And not to get on, like, listen, it just shows though how sport is cruel. Yeah. It really is sport. There's no sentiment in sport, as beautiful a game as it is. Coaches are there to make these decisions, and they're ruthless. And listen, that's why they get to the level that they are. And Jim Gavin, of course, listen, he's so successful. But, yeah. You know, unfortunately, you kind of wish that you get your last little bit of success, but it doesn't always work out that way.
You want the fairy tale ending. It doesn't always come, unfortunately. But
we all do.
I read Damien Lawler's book, when the World Stops Watching. And obviously read your piece about life after sport. How did that transition go? And I know we'll chat about the business piece, which I'm massively interested in, and watch what you're doing. I love how you've kind of transitioned. But the emotional side that I'm genuinely coming into now, I watched my first two games with Dublin while not been around. It's the first time in, I think, since 2001 at Brogan hasn't been part of the Dubs.
Yeah.
Did you get pangs or just when was the toughest moments, or was there tough moments, or did you keep yourself too busy to even think about it? I know you got straight into punditry and presenting, stuff like that, and you were very busy, but was there those pangs that I'm sure I'm going to get?
Big time. And I think, listen, it's natural that you're going to get those. The big pang for me was, I remember when Ireland won the Grand Slam, I think was it 2018. And it was that year that I said it was that final year where I just was enjoying my rugby. But I was off in England doing a corporate gig with Donica O'Callaghan and Jamie Heaslip. And we were in Twickenham when Ireland won the Grand Slam. And we, the three of us, had been part of the last team to win a Grand Slam. And we'd waited 61 years to win that Grand Slam. And then they went off and did it in 9. So we didn't really get to enjoy it too much. But I remember myself and Dunica kind of going, well, listen, that's the way it is. But Jamie, who was with us, you could see it really was hitting him. And, you know, it's not easy because, you know, Jamie in particular, probably if he had been fit, he would have been out on the park that day. But for me, I did a documentary whenever I retired, and I chatted to a couple of different sports people. And I remember AP McCoy was one of them. And he retired from being a jump jockey after being the 20-time champion jockey, whatever. So he retired at the top of his game. And you could see, even 3 years after, he still missed it so much. Nothing could create the buzz, and he craved it. And I could see that it was eating him away inside. And he said he was doing the television stuff, but it just doesn't tick that box that he got. And it was actually the fear that he missed, the fear of hurting himself, which was incredible. But I also spoke to Dermot O'Rourke, the athlete, the sprinter, and I went down to Cork to meet her, and, you know, I knew a lot about Dervil, and I just figured as an individual athlete that she would be so focused and so regimented, and that she would really miss it. which her story really hit home with me the most. And I remember she told me she'd been at the World Indoor Athletics event. And I asked her the same question. I said, did you miss it? Did you like? And she said, no. Do you know what? I stood there and I looked at them all on the start line and I thought back to myself, how fortunate was I to think that I was there? You know, a couple of years ago, I was there and I won a medal. I won a race in this. And, you know, you spend your whole career looking forward and chasing and chasing and chasing. And you never actually look back and reflect on actually the good times. And I think it's very important when you do come to the end to try and not look at the team out there going on and winning six in a row and actually just thinking, listen, I was there for five of those. Yeah. You won six All-Irelands yourself, I think.
Seven.
Just appreciating how lucky we've been. And it's just so not in a sports person's nature. But Derval really hit home with me that day, that to really appreciate it and think, wow, you were there. Like you looked up at that crowd and what everyone in that crowd would have done to be where you were just that once.
Yeah.
So that hit home for me.
Yeah, you're dead right. And I had the same when I was actually handing in, when retiring, meeting the gym. Someone said to me, my wife actually said to me, and one of my business partners in the bars I'm in, Alan Clancy, said, forget about the last bit of hurt you had in the last year. Look at your career as a whole. You're 15 years with Dublin. Look at the memories, the seven All-Irelands, the weekends away, the nights, the glory, everything, and the good and bad days. And he says, look at it as a whole, not just looking at, I didn't play the last week, you know what I mean? And that's what you say there. Take the positive out of things, and sometimes is that we're hungry and we're aggressive and we're trying to always get after things, but sometimes just taking a step back and looking is as important.
And we're wired that way. Yeah. That's why you get to the level that you're at, is that you're wired to want more. And you know, it's that competitiveness that gets you to that level to have won as much as you have. And it does take a bit, it's not easy to just step away and try and look back and remember the good things, but it's not about the medals though, as you know yourself, Bernard, it's missing the change room after and the crack, you know, you have in the change room, the buzz of being, you know, having a beer or a cup of tea, whatever it is, with those players that you went through those memories with, and those are the memories that stick with me more than anything.
Yeah, 100%. So you're obviously very busy now. I actually did a little test on last Friday. I ordered some 15 Kings, as you can see here. Oh, everyone.
Yeah, good man.
Yeah,
there you go.
Looking good. I was actually worried coming on this morning because the last time I went on to Ireland AM with you, we were wearing the same outfit. So you're not wearing the same shirt as me, because I know you have all the gear. But yeah, like that obviously you've transitioned your transition. I've watched you avidly through your transition in the media and in business. And I know you, like myself, I set up a business at 27 in the middle of my career. I know we're not professional and we have time to do that, I suppose. But you always had that look at business and at your future. How has that been? And how has, I suppose, the recently been? Like, I ordered this on Friday, landed on Tuesday morning. There was good service. I got two text messages in the middle of it telling me where I was at. So you're obviously...
You mustn't put your name in. Jeez, if we had a senior
not
name...
Not at all. No, this is part of the... It was a test, because I hadn't arrived, I was going to give out, but it did.
Oh, that's good.
So how's it been during the COVID? And the online, obviously, has come up massively.
Listen, it's... It's funny. I just did a video there a week or two ago with the shoes, and I started the shoes back in 2009, which is incredible. That's 11 years that we're going, and we're in nearly 200 shops all over the country, which is just phenomenal. But this has been the biggest challenge to all those shops, and my job really with the clothes and the shoes in particular is I am out meeting. You know, and it's difficult now with this job with Ireland AM. Yeah. But before this, I have been traveled to every corner around Ireland, meeting the shop owners, chatting to customers, finding out about sizes and finding out what works, what doesn't work, and getting to know your customer. That's the biggest thing. And certainly the shops that we deal with, this, you know, the high street was struggling before coronavirus hit. Now it's at a whole new level. Yeah. And yes, you bought that online, but we actually don't even promote our online service because if we sell our products online, it means that you could have been in a shop in Best Menswear, say in Dublin, and they didn't have a medium and they say, listen, we'll have it for you tomorrow, but you could have just went and bought it off our website and they lose out on a sale. So actually we want to try and push customers towards those shops. If Best Menswear want to sell them online, great, go for it. We're just trying to provide a good product that they feel is that they want to push it, but at a good price point too. But listen, fashion and clothing and footwear, it is a minefield. And it's something that at the start, when I first got into it, I didn't know the level of detail that goes into it. And, you know, trying to get sizing, you know, this shirt, you know, it's made in one factory. The shirt that you're wearing is made in a different factory. So the dimensions that we give this factory is different. You know, they just come back differently. Sometimes the stretch of the material. So again, like I said, sport, some people have to be fully, fully focused on it. But I just love juggling. I love having so many different things. My wife, people always say to my wife, you know, what am I like when I'm at home? And how is he coping with this Ireland AM gig, with the clothes and shoes and with the rugby? Yeah. But she just knows that I'm only happy when I'm busy. Yeah. You know, when I'm like that, through that lockdown for 4 months, the rugby stopped, the clothes and shoes, all the shops closed. Yeah. We were trying to order stuff and show the shops like Zoom images of products that we're going to sell in the autumn, winter and spring, summer. And it was tough, and I wasn't busy. And I had to it took a real readjustment to get back to home life. And we just had a baby boy literally at the start of lockdown. And again, so not much sleep at that stage either. But it took me a while to get used to it. And listen, I'd be first to admit it. I really struggled with the whole lockdown. And I'm loving being back up and going, back busy again. And because of that, whenever I get home, I think I'm a much better dad. I'm much better to be around. That, you know, I feel that I've got rid of everything work-wise. As soon as I come in through the door, it's a huge focus for me to just leave my phone at the door, leave my keys there, and just try and immerse myself in the two kids and my wife. So, But listen, you know yourself, Bernard, like, it's life after sport. Whenever you retire from sport, what you put into Gaelic football, what I put into rugby, like so many players who retire from rugby, you start at the bottom rung. So I got into television. I was so, so lucky that Air Sport gave me an opportunity. And I think 2 years before I'd retired, or a year, I had to go. I heard about a holiday show that BBC Northern Ireland and RTE were doing, and that they were looking for a presenter. And I had to go and do a show reel. I had to go and do 2 screen tests for it. And I was learning all my lines, talking about, you know, this is a big tower in this street. So I actually got the gig, and I presented Getaways for 2 years with Vogue Williams and Mairead Ronan. And that gave me the confidence to speak into camera. But while doing that, we had to go away and visit 3 different locations, which was amazing. But my wife wasn't happy, because as a rugby player, you only get 4 weeks holidays. And we just had a baby at that stage. Emma was just born. And I went off to Ibiza for a week with Vogue Williams to film this holiday show. And that was one of my 4 weeks holidays. So we ended up only getting 1 week holidays before I got back into the rugby season again. So it was that commitment to do that. And that kind of gave me that springboard to get into Air Sport. And then, you know, fortunate to get into Ireland AM here as well.
Yeah, it's been an amazing transition, and one that I watch you closely and look up to the route you've taken. So fair play on that. And I really want to thank you for today, for coming on. I know you're very busy with Ireland AM, the rugby, Lloyd and Price, 15 Kings, your family. I'm a similar mindset. I love staying busy.
No,
I love
a
different day. Every day is different. So thanks a million for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
Bernard, listen, huge fan of everything you, Alan, the whole lot have done. So listen, congratulations to you. What a successful career you had as well. So listen, I'd love to catch up with you for a coffee as well another time.
Absolutely.
So thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining me on the Bernard Brogan podcast, brought to you by Super Value, proud sponsors of the 2020 Championship. I'm delighted to announce that I have my good pal Jack McCaffrey joining me next week for episode 3. Please subscribe to OTB GAA and check it out there.
The Bernard Brogan Podcast and OTB Sports, brought to you by Super Value, proud sponsors of the GAA All-Ireland Football Championship for over 11 years.